Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Have you tried beet juice, baking soda, blood tests? We'll hear the latest in low and high technology for elite athletes.
But first, nurse Casey Hickox has now defied Maine's 21-day Ebola quarantine order more than once. First speaking to reporters outside her house last night, and this morning, going on a bike ride with her boyfriend. Maine officials want a court to enforce the quarantine order until it expires on November 10th. Hickox returned to the U.S. after treating Ebola patients in Sierra Leone for Doctors Without Borders and was initially quarantined in New Jersey before being allowed to return home to Maine. So how far can a state go to enforce a quarantine order? Robert Gatter is co-director of the Center for Health Law Studies at St. Louis University. Professor Gatter, welcome.
Thank you.
So Casey Hickox, as we know, has no symptoms of Ebola. Does she have a case? Is it not legal for the state of Maine to tell her she's got to stay in her home?
She does have a case, Jeremy, and she has a pretty good one. The law needs to defer to the science, and the science is clear. If you're asymptomatic for Ebola, you're not infectious for it. She can't communicate it. What we don't know is whether or not it's incubating in her body. But while it's incubating, she is not infectious.
But isn't it reasonable for authorities to take precautions because the moment that she becomes symptomatic, if she does have Ebola, then she is infectious and then it may be too late and she may already be talking to the mailman or down at the supermarket or whatever?
Well, I think reasonable is the key word. Reasonable should be tied to the science. If we tie it to the science, then yes, there are some steps that states can take. For example, I think it's perfectly legitimate for a state to order that someone who is asymptomatic be subject to public health workers laying eyes on them, testing them with the blood test to see if any level for Ebola has risen, taking their temperatures, continuing to ask them questions about what sort of physical symptoms they're having. But mandating that someone be quarantined as if they're infectious is inconsistent with the science and so unreasonable.
Let's look at the precedent for this, because I know that this goes all the way back to 1872. There's power under U.S. law to prevent the spread, in that case, of yellow fever. There was a quarantine put into effect during the influenza pandemic of 1917-1918. Tell us about the history of this.
Well, I think the most important piece of history here isn't so much precedent at the federal level. It is an understanding of our two governmental system. States are the ones with the police power, and states are the ones who are going to be dealing with individuals who were exposed to Ebola and may become infectious. The way the CDC guidelines are working is that individuals who enter the country initially are questioned and evaluated by federal authorities, but if they're going to be quarantined, if they're going to be subject to further observation, they're fairly quickly handed off to state officials. And state law ends up being the most important then. Every state has the police power. The police power allows states to take actions to protect the welfare, health, and safety of their citizens. And that's where this would fall. And that power is broad, but it's not unlimited, and it's still subject to individual rights protected under the federal constitution. And that's where the fight will be. The key will be whether or not restricting movement of someone who is asymptomatic for Ebola is a fundamental liberty interest under the 14th Amendment. And I believe it is. Necessity would require the state to put on evidence of why someone who is asymptomatic for Ebola poses a health risk to others. And the science right now says that that individual is not.
But again, that individual becomes a problem as soon as that individual becomes symptomatic. The moment that that individual is symptomatic, and that could happen when they're out on the town and with other people. So doesn't the state have some discretion in deciding that they are a public health threat even before they become symptomatic?
Yes, but monitoring is not the same thing as quarantining. I think it's perfectly legitimate for the state, and I think they can make the case that it is necessary to monitor someone like Nurse Hickox. That could include knowing her whereabouts. That could include having a public health worker take her temperature once, twice, three times a day. But it needs to be tied to the science. I have asked some infectious disease experts about the process of becoming infectious, and the answer that I'm given is they will spike a fever first, and that's the warning sign. Then they go to the hospital. When they become really dangerous is when they start losing lots of bodily fluids in large amounts, but that does not happen instantaneously. So someone, as I understand it, can't become an immediate danger. They spike the fever, and that's the warning sign that they do, in fact, have the disease.
Do you think this is going to end up at the Supreme Court?
No, I don't. I think this is going to be resolved mostly at state court levels. I think the United States Supreme Court would lay back and watch what happens. Some federal courts may get involved. But by the time it could make its way there, I believe that the international outbreak of Ebola will be contained and people will be a lot less scared.
Robert Gatter, co-director of the Center for Health Law Studies at St. Louis University, thanks so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And we want to take a look now at the latest in sports technology. Mark McCluskey is the editor of Wired.com, where they live on the leading edge of tech. But so do the subjects in his new book. It's called Faster, Higher, Stronger: How Sports Science is Creating a New Generation of Super Athletes and What We Can Learn from Them. Everything from the latest elixirs, have you heard about beet juice, to the data-driven science. Forget that 10,000 hours thing. Tall is good for rowing, so Britain advertised for tall people to row. Shortly after, they were competing and winning. Mark McCluskey joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Start with the basic premise that you do in the book, that most of the huge accomplishments that have been made in the elite world of athletics have already been made. It's now a matter of an aggregation of marginal gains.
Yeah, if you look at sort of our rate of improvement across Olympic events over time, we're not getting better as quickly as we got better in the past. And the main reason for that is we've done all the easy stuff. You know, 50 years ago, we barely understood interval training. We didn't understand nutrition, how to rest after a workout most effectively. And so we've sort of checked off all of those big boxes. Now what's left, and you mentioned it, this idea of the aggregation of marginal gains, that it's stacking lots of little improvements on top of one another is how you get to big improvement now in the sports world.
Well, and every athlete is looking for that little thing. Let's do a lightning round of just the simpler things that top athletes are trying. Beet juice?
Beet juice. So what beet juice does, the nitrates in beet juice are changed into nitrite and then into nitric oxide in your body. And what that does is it dilates your blood vessels. It allows more blood to flow through them. And especially for events from sort of 5 to 30 minutes long, that's a huge advantage. You get more blood into the muscle and you can power the muscle more effectively. So there's been a lot of research on this in the past few years. Andy Jones is a researcher who's led most of this in the UK, and he was telling me that actually during the 2012 Olympics in London, it was really hard to actually buy beet juice around the Olympic Stadium because every country was trying to use it. It seems to have about a 3% positive effect in some of the studies.
Okay, there's that. But what about baking soda?
Baking soda acts as what's called an intercellular buffer. It's an antacid for your blood, basically. And so when your blood gets more acidic with waste products after working out, that can have negative effects on the power of your muscles. And so baking soda seems to delay that effect. The downside of it is it's really hard to eat enough baking soda to have this effect. For somebody, you know, who's about 175 pounds, that's about a quarter cup of baking soda, which doesn't sound like very much until you try and do it. The delicate term is gastric distress.
that will occur.
Is what people suffer. Yes.
Yeah. So don't be doing this, you know, unless you really, really get immersed in the science of it. Rollers. You went to Sparta Performance Center in Menlo Park. They were using pipes for athletes to roll on instead of stretching. And there's science that shows that actually stretching isn't as good for you as rolling.
So the sort of stretching that we all grew up doing, right? Like before we're going to run, we're going to stand there, we're going to like bend from side to side, and we're going to touch our toes. It is not particularly effective and, in fact, might actually decrease your performance. You know, a better sort of warm-up is just starting to move around some, getting the blood flowing in your muscles. And then, yeah, foam rollers, which is what a lot of people use, are really effective in sort of starting to loosen up your muscles without some of the negative consequences of what's called static stretching, that sort of toe-touching thing. And then at Sparta, they take it a step further. It's PVC pipes, and you know, they're very firm, and you have to definitely get used to that amount of pressure on your muscles, but they swear by it there.
Well, there's just so many of these little tips. Sparta also tells athletes to eat a gram of protein a day for every pound of their weight. If you're 250 pounds, that's 250 grams of protein. That would be way too much for a lot of people. You also say there's science that shows that just rinsing your mouth with carbs, what tricks the brain into thinking you had the benefit of them?
The brain lies at the center of so much of our lives. There's been this incredible research done about, mouth rinsing, basically, with carbohydrate solutions. And so the working theory right now is that we have receptors in our mouth that detect carbohydrate. And in anticipation of that carbohydrate entering the body, we'll sort of release more energy into our effort. But even if you rinse out your mouth and spit out the carbohydrates, you can still see that performance benefit.
But then there's the deep science. All elite athletes, it seems, are taking part in getting hooked up to machines, getting their blood tested. You did some of this testing yourself, sending your blood to Inside Tracker, a company in Boston that looks for 20 different biomarkers and then advises you on how they can be optimized for athletic performance. What did you learn?
They draw a distinction there between sort of clinical deficiency and deficiency for optimized athletic performance. And let me draw that distinction. You know, my vitamin D levels are fine for sort of the National Institute of Health guidelines. In their studies, and what they do is they collate a lot of outside scientific research, my levels are a little bit low. The other thing I found out is, and this is particularly difficult to hear as a 40-something male, my testosterone was a little bit low given their guidelines. You know, testosterone is an incredible performance enhancer for almost every facet of physical performance. And so making sure that those levels are high without doing anything illegal like doping and taking testosterone, you know, is something that they're going to push their clients into. You know, for vitamins, it's easier. It's supplementation. For testosterone, it's things like reducing stress.
It's Here and Now. Did you catch the Lakers-Rockets game the other night? Kobe Bryant trying to make shots, Dwight Howard trying to stop him. It reminded us of a chapter in Mark McCluskey's new book about something called the Dwight Effect, a finding that while NBA star Dwight Howard doesn't lead the league in block shots, he does lead the league in invisible blocks. His very presence makes players shoot less. How was this discovered? By a geographer named Kirk Goldsberry, who mapped the spatial coordinates of every shot taken in the NBA for 6 years. Now, many teams are paying $100,000 for a camera system called SportView that will do the same thing for them. It's just part of the technology that Mark McCluskey, editor of Wired.com, writes about in his new book, Faster, Higher, Stronger. There's also a gadget called the Optimi from a company called Catapult. Mark, start there. Australian rules football team coaches are using this to have real-time data sent to their iPads during games?
Yeah, the explosion of data in the past 10 years has really had a massive effect on sports. And Catapult is an Australian company, and they actually have a small unit that actually sort of attaches and sort of nestles in between the shoulder blades of each player. And it's got GPS and it's got accelerometers. And so in real time, as you say, I can see not only where somebody's running, but how quickly they're accelerating or decelerating. When they get tackled, I can see how hard they were hit. What Catapult has done is write software that starts to flag players like, this guy is slowing down, this guy's taken a couple of really big hits, perhaps he's not as effective right now as he was 5 minutes ago, he'd be a good candidate to substitute.
There seems to be something very wrong with that. You know, that the coach should be able to see. It sort of changes the job from a human one to a computer one.
I see what you're saying. I think that these things are incredibly hard to see. You know, I think a consistent theme in the book is how small these changes in margins are, and coaches can't see them. Like slowing down a third of a mile an hour in my top sprint speed is imperceptible to the naked eye, especially in the context of a game.
You look at the science that is continuing to smash some of our thinking about athletes, that, for instance, they're born not made, but they are being made.
Great Britain sort of has taken a big leadership position in a lot of these areas, and they look at events in a very specific way. They sort of break down what are the factors that lead to success in these events. And one factor that leads to success in rowing, one factor is your height. you're pulling an oar, and the more distance you can move that, the better. So they talk about having long levers as being a good thing to have. What they started was a program, and I love the name of it. They called it Sporting Giants. They put out a national call for people above a certain height who were playing other sports and said, hey, if you're above a certain height, we'd like to meet you. We'd like to test you and do some physiological tests. And through that program, they identified gold medalists. Helen Glover was part of a crew that won the first gold medal for Great Britain in the 2012 Olympics in London. And she had only been in a boat for about 2 years. She'd been a field hockey player her whole life. But her mother saw an ad in a newspaper for this program, and Helen went in and was tested and became a gold medalist.
Yeah. And Britain did something with its data to make its entire cycling team better.
Dave Brailes ran British cycling for about a decade, and the aggregation of marginal gains is his phrase. It's his notion of piling up all those little tiny improvements over time. So he really focused the entire organization not around like, okay, let's look for some big crazy thing that might get us a 2% improvement, because those 2% improvements don't exist anymore at this level. He's focused on, let's find a tenth of a percent. So we're going to spray down our tires with alcohol before the start of a track cycling race, which is a standing start. You're motionless and you take off, because we might get a tiny bit more traction out of that. We'll develop with Adidas pants that keep the cyclist's legs warmer after they warm up, so that as they're waiting for their race to start, the benefits of the warm-up don't go away as their body cools off. You know, they look at everything. They travel with their own pillows, mm-hmm. so they're comfortable in hotel rooms, and they don't run the risk of waking up with a sore neck or catching something that's left on a pillow from the previous occupant of the room.
Or so that they sleep better. And you have a whole chapter on sleep, the importance of sleep, the studies that show that the athletes that have a good night's sleep absolutely do better than their peers.
Yeah, sleep is amazing. Sleep is such a powerful recovery tool. And, you know, recovery has become this thing about hydrotherapy baths and compression tights, you know, those stretchy tights that runners and cyclists tend to wear. But sleeping... And sleeping as much as possible. When you talk to elite athletes, they talk about sleep all the time because they're amazing nappers, because they have to be and because they're exerting so much energy. And it can be not just a way of protecting your abilities, but there have been some really cool studies. Sherry Ma is a researcher down at Stanford, and she did a study where she asked the Stanford men's basketball team to extend their sleep, to sleep as much as they possibly could, which is hard to get college kids to do, but they did it. And their performance skyrocketed. I mean, things like 17% improvement in sprint time testing, which that's the sort of improvement you actually usually only see from things like doping. And so the idea that sleep can be such a powerful performance enhancer is a really, I think, a super important reminder to all of us.
Oh, there's so much more here. Running, most elite runners are about the same. It's how much force is in your footfall that actually makes you run faster. Usain Bolt has 1,000 pounds of force when his leg makes contact with the running surface. So you want to run faster, do leg presses.
We often think of running as not something that's particularly strength-based, right? And I think a lot of people think to run faster, what they need to do is move their legs more quickly. That's really hard to do. And research has shown that most of us have about the same leg swing time. Everyone from Usain Bolt to me, to you, to probably
impossible,
not my grandmother. So the difference is not how quickly we take strides. It's how much force we generate with each stride. During that contact time that we have with the ground, how much force can we apply, right? Because just physics tells us that's how we move forward, is applying force to the ground. And the greater the force, the more quickly we will move forward.
Yeah. Well, but then the bottom line question is, and you pose it, when does this stop? Where's this all going? And if we're incrementally breaking records, getting faster, higher, stronger, as your book title is there a point where it just has to stop because we run out of the human capability? You ask, will my kids see records broken? And, you know, is the answer maybe not? What's the answer?
How I sort of end the book is grappling with this existential question, because it's, of course, part of why we're so drawn to sports, right, is that idea of seeing something that's never happened before. Like, nobody has ever run as fast as that. Mm. Like, that's an amazing thing to watch. I think we will continue to see records for a while. I think we will see fewer through time, and I think we will see them broken by smaller and smaller margins through time. You know, I posed this question. Andy Walsh is a researcher who works for Red Bull, the beverage company, and he previously worked at the U.S. ski team as their director of high performance. I'm like, well, you know, no one will ever run 100 meters in 6 seconds, right? You know, the record right now is 9.67 seconds. You know, nobody's ever going to run 6 seconds. And he's like, well, why not? Think about how our ancestors moved. Apes, right? We run much more quickly than apes. Somebody will run 100 meters in 6 seconds, but they might not look anything like we look today.
That's Mark McCluskey. His book is Faster, Higher, Stronger, How Sports Science is Creating a New Generation of Super Athletes and What We Can Learn from Them. He's also editor of Wired.com. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was that. The San Francisco Giants ending Kansas City's storybook season with a 3-2 win over the Royals in Game 7 of the World Series last night in Kansas City, giving the Giants 3 titles in the last 5 years. The headline in the San Francisco Chronicle reads simply, Dynasty. The Kansas City Star headline reads, Loss Won't Diminish Royals' Magic Season. And it was a magic season. It was the Royals' first playoff since 1985 when they beat the St. Louis Cardinals to win their only World Series title. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst and host of the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, it was a nail-biter in Game 7, but the Giants had a hero in this pitcher, Madison Bumgarner.
Oh, so amazing. Bumgarner on 2 days rest. And this not just is it not done, you get 5 days rest between pitches. Because it's not done, the pitcher's body is not used to it. And as great as Bumgarner won, he had the win in game one. He only gave up a run, and that was after the game was put away. Had a complete game, 9 innings in game 5. 2 days rest. Maybe you'll get an inning out of him. Maybe you'll get two. Gives you 5 innings. 5 scoreless innings. Amazing.
But the Royals made a lot of mistakes.
Well, I would say the Royals did great. And yes, the difference between winning is the word dynasty and losing is loss won't diminish Royals' magic season. That is true. But Eric Hosmer slides into first base instead of running through it. That would have got him out of a double play. It was looked at first time World Series looked at the TV review. Eric Gordon did not hustle as much as he could have. He ran pretty hard, but with 2 outs in the bottom of the ninth of the World Series, the ball got past the center fielder Blanco, was booted out in the outfield. There is a possibility, however small, that Gordon could have tied the game on not an inside the park home run, but a triple and an error if he had been running 100%. There was a fly ball that Pablo Sandoval, the San Francisco player, tagged up on. I don't think that was handled well. There was Ned Yost bunting when he shouldn't have. And the big thing is, as great as Bumgarner was, the Royals swung at everything. And maybe this is because they had faced him before and they said, look, we're only going to get strikes. It wasn't the case. He was in and out of the zone, but the Royals did him a favor by just swinging at pitches that were way out of the zone. That made Bumgarner, well, you could argue maybe Bumgarner didn't need to come into the zone if they were going to swing so freely, but I think that did hurt the Royals for sure.
And what about this dynasty label for the Giants? 3 World Series titles in 5 years.
I think it's true. I think it's apt. I think that in this day and age where you can't retain players forever, like, you know, the Yankees could with the reserve clause, the fact that their GM, Brian Sabian, puts these rosters together and Buster Posey is a constant and there are a few guys who are constant, but, you know, guys are going to go and guys have come and guys have gone. And Tim Lincecum, a great pitcher, the last couple World Series, this World Series had a very, very minor role. It's extremely apt to call them a dynasty. I agree with that label.
Okay. And let me ask you this. Were people watching because there were these chances for these great series that would have had two teams that were near each other playing? There was the possibility that the Orioles and the Nationals would make it. They didn't. There was a possibility that we would have a show me series in the Royals and the Cardinals. There were some California teams that were in the mix, but that didn't happen. And the ratings weren't very good, right?
Yes, that's true. But compare it to everything on TV. It's a little unfair to say that the ratings weren't good. Compare it to what ratings the Golden Girls got back in the 80s and whatever the number one sitcom is now, Community, to pick a sitcom that actually has bad ratings. But anyway, they always compare it to the NFL. The NFL is the exception. All ratings are down. Baseball is local. If you didn't watch Game 7, is that the fault of baseball? You missed a great game.
Mike Pesca, here now, sports analyst, host the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
And some sad news now from the city where we broadcast this show. Former Boston Mayor Tom Menino, who served 5 terms in City Hall and guided the city into the 21st century, died today of cancer at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He was 71 years old. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's Dolores Handy has our story on the mayor and his legacy.
Thomas Michael Menino loved the city of Boston, loved his job, and loved the fact that he could change people's lives just by being mayor. He could be hard-nosed in pushing for what he felt was needed, determined to wield the power of his office. He pushed hard, even when late in the last of his 5 terms as mayor, he had to sometimes govern from a hospital room, venturing out in a wheelchair. That was the case April 15, 2013, when twin explosions near the Boston Marathon finish line killed 3 people and injured hundreds more.
And all the sunshine,
Days after the bombings, Menino stood up from his wheelchair, joining President Obama, Governor Patrick, and 2,000 other mourners at a memorial service for the bombing victims.
Nothing can defeat the heart of the city. Nothing. Nothing will take us down because we take care of one another. Even with the smell of a smoke in the air and blood on the streets, tears in our eyes, we triumphed over that hateful act on Monday afternoon.
Menino was not a gifted orator. Voters shrugged off his occasional malapropism or his mangling of a name. The name Mumbles Menino did not bother him.
Oh, it's a wonderful name. I just carry me. Hey, just think about it. I'm Mumbles, but I've been mayor for 20 years. Nobody else been Mumbles and I've been mayor for 20 years.
The son of Carl and Susan Menino, Tom Menino was born in the Reedville section of Boston's Hyde Park neighborhood. His father was a factory foreman. In 1960, he graduated from St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Jamaica Plain. He got a job selling insurance. He enrolled in night courses at Boston College, but didn't last. He reportedly told his father, Harry Truman didn't go to college. He began working on the side in politics. Former state senator Joseph Timolte met the future mayor when Menino volunteered on Timolte's campaign for city council in the 1960s.
He loved the business, from gathering signatures to arranging house parties to going door to door.
His first 10 years, the slogan for his administration was getting the job done.
Former state representative Charlotte Goler Ritchie left the State House to join Menino's cabinet.
He made the city a more open and accessible place.
Menino became known as the urban mechanic. He got the potholes fixed, and he transformed an industrial section of South Boston into the gleaming new innovation district, South Boston Seaport. Even those who butted heads with Menino offer praise. City Councilor Charles Yancey was often on the receiving end of Menino's sharp tongue.
I think Tom Menino will be recognized not only for helping to stabilize the finances of the city, which he did, not only for advocating clean air with regards to tobacco in the city of Boston. He deserves credit for that. He also deserves credit for taking some out-of-the-box positions against some fairly controversial social issues, like gay rights and particularly marriage equality.
There's that kind of cliche expression that the rising tide lifts all the boats. But we know that that's not always true.
Boston businessman Jack Connors.
In Tom Menino's city, it was more true than it was in many other cities around the country and around the world. Because if there was success, then Tom Menino wanted to be sure that the folks who didn't have a voice shared in that success.
Connors credits Menino for inspiring and for helping him create a summer camp for city kids on Long Island in Boston Harbor.
This is a guy who cared more than almost anyone I've ever met about doing the right thing for the folks that didn't have a voice.
In Menino's recently published autobiography, Mayor for a New America, he writes with pride about the evolution of Boston, saying it was broken up racially when he assumed office, but has become a much more inclusive city. As he was leaving office, Menino spoke to WBUR.
You know, I'm not a fancy guy, that's for sure. But whatever I did, I thought was the right thing for the young people, for the adults, for the business community. When you take the oath as mayor, You're mayor of all the people. And how do you improve all their lives, not just some of their lives?
Last February, just a month after leaving office, Menino was diagnosed with an advanced form of cancer. It had spread to his liver and lymph nodes. Thomas Michael Menino, Boston's first Italian-American mayor. His name now etched in Boston history, the 53rd mayor of one of America's oldest cities. He held that office longer than any other. For Here and Now, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
And reaction is pouring in from around the country today. WBUR reporter Asma Khalid joins us to tell us about some of it. Asma, we've got a statement from President Obama.
That's right. The president issued a statement praising the mayor for turning his hometown essentially into a world-class city. He said Mayor Tom Menino was bold, big-hearted, and Boston strong. Tom, he says, was the embodiment of the city he loved and led for more than two decades.
And Secretary of State John Kerry, who still spends some time in Boston, he's got a house here, he also released a statement.
That's right. He said Tom Menino was Boston. In fact, if you just look around the city, you'll see with your own eyes that he is Boston today. He said that others talked, Tommy worked. And he praised Tom Menino for being a sort of street politician, this urban mechanic who knew how to fix things and get things done.
And he had respect from other mayors around the country. He was a leader among U.S. mayors. I know we've heard today from former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg.
That's right. They were actually close partners. They worked together on reducing gun violence. And former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg said that Tom Menino was a man who was never afraid to take on tough issues. He specifically praised him and said that in the aftermath of the marathon bombing last year, he was steady as always, showing the same determined leadership that made his career in public service one of Boston's most important and most influential.
He also brought the Democratic National Convention to Boston in 2004. We heard today from the current chairwoman of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who offered her respects.
That's right. I mean, he was this mayor who, you know, most mayors may not be known on a national stage, but he was. And she praised him, saying that there are few figures so intimately connected with her hometown as were Tom Menino and Boston. He loved the city and its people and devoted his life to them. For that, they loved him back.
Asma Khalid, reporter here at WBUR in Boston, and the sad news that Boston's former mayor, Tom Menino, has died at the age of 71. Asma, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and now we want to go on stage. Our look at what's happening across the country, from Renaissance fairs to marching band competitions to celebrations of tap. That's a tap dancing flash mob in Balboa Park in San Diego. Before that, we heard the Jerk Dance Group tap dancing at the Andy Williams Moon River Theater in Branson, Missouri. And we started with sound from the Downtown Dance Festival in Battery Park, Manhattan. And tomorrow night, the 1920s-inspired Harlem Nights in Chicago, featuring a speakeasy, a soiree, a murder mystery, and tap dancing, period dress required. The Chicago dance group Mad Rhythms, Mad as in making a difference dancing, will perform. Founder and director Brill Barrett joins us from WBEZ in Chicago. Brill, we want to hear more. A soiree?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, it's for people who are, you know, they don't want to do the traditional Halloween dress up, go out. This speaks to people who may be into the 1920s, the 30s, 40s, the times when speakeasies and bootleggers and all of that stuff, you know, was popular. And of course, tap dancing was just getting popular at that same time. So I'm fortunate and honored to be presenting tap dance as part of that event, because you don't see tap dance and Halloween parties very often.
Very often. But you're right. When you think of the 1920s, you do think, the Roaring Twenties,
yeah,
you do think of tap dancers. For instance, we understand you'll be performing to songs like Ella Fitzgerald's It Don't Mean a Thing. Let's listen.
Yeah.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do-a, 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 do-a. It don't mean a thing. All you gotta do is sing. Do-a, 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 do-a.
Are your feet moving?
Exactly. Under the desk right now, my feet, they started going as soon as it came on.
Tell us about MADD, Making a Difference Dancing.
Well, Mad Rhythms, and again, yes, Mad is M-A-D-D. It's tap dance has been the vehicle that made a difference in my life. I could have easily ended up a statistic or went down the wrong path because of my family's lack of financial means or the neighborhood I grew up in. But the art of tap dance, when I was exposed to it, I grew to love it, and it made a difference in how I interpret the world and rhythm and all of those things. So I felt it was my duty to create an entity or a company that could turn around and do the same thing, make a difference in the lives of people just by way of the tap dance itself, but also by doing a lot of community work to expose young people who might not otherwise be exposed to this great art form.
Here's a little of a sound of a recent performance at Malcolm X College in Chicago. I love the sound of tap. I just love it. Again, your feet are moving, I'm sure. Well, what we're seeing here, five people, men and women, standing on stage facing each other, their feet going like crazy. What is there? Is this sort of like a tap-off? What's happening there?
We call it the cipher, but part of the history of tap dance is this thing called the challenge. And everybody knows, if you've ever seen some of the older musicals, there's always a tap-off, but a challenge. there's an old Bill Cosby from The Cosby Show where Bill Cosby challenges Sandman Sims to a tap-off.
Challenge!
And it's the funniest thing you have ever seen. But yeah, so when you see dancers in a semicircle, it's representative of the art form and how the challenge or one-upping each other is part of the way we learn and grow and the way we vibe with one another.
Yeah. And do these young people know about, you know, you mentioned one iconic tapper, but the modern day, Savion Glover and the younger ones, do they know about them?
Yeah, well, we make it a point in teaching tap to truly teach the culture and the history of the dance. Because to really understand tap, you have to know where it came from. You have to know the highs and the lows. And I think it fosters an appreciation that then you take into your artistic endeavors and add to it. So, you know, most of them know about Savion Glover, but we want to make sure they know also about Gregory Hines and the Nicholas Brothers. And Lon Chaney and Dr. Jimmy Slide and, you know, the Hoofers that created the art form that came before us.
Yeah. William Henry Lane.
Oh, yeah.
Known
Master
as
Juba.
Well, we have a sound of a class you helped to organize in an event people know about well there, the Chicago Tap Summit. Let's listen. What we're seeing here is a room of about a dozen students all tapping, clapping, and you do tap programs in Chicago schools as well. How do they react?
Oh, you know what's funny? It's great now, but in the beginning it was a lot of, because most young people weren't exposed to tap. They didn't think it was cool. They didn't see it on a regular basis. So because of that, they didn't want to do it. So we were connected historically to other things that they may know. Like in Chicago, footworking is extremely popular because it was created in Chicago. But tap dancing is a predecessor to footworking. So by connecting it, we got a lot of young people into it. And now it's a lot easier because there's a culture of young people that know about tap. And like one of the places we teach on the west side of Chicago, the Better Boys Foundation, the children there all strive to be old enough to move up to the tap program, which we do for the teens there.
Well, but you're competing with, you know, jukin, you know, other dance genres, you know. Do you feel that? Or do you, maybe somebody into jukin would also take up tap?
Yeah, well, and that's the first thing. A couple of years back, I did this thing called the Juke Tap Project, and it was literally jukin or footworking to juke music, but teaching those footworkers how to tap. And the funny thing is, like, there's one member of my company. Her name is Donetta Jackson. They call her Lil Bit. She's a tap dancer, but she's also part of the Footwork Kings, which is a footwork group. So she's like our bridge. So in a lot of performances, we have her footwork, and the kids go crazy. And then she then tells them that it was easy for her to learn footwork because she was a tap dancer. and they go, whoa.
Now you've got them. By the way, we should explain Jukin. I mean, you're up on the balls of your feet, but maybe your knees bent in a back bend. I mean, how would you describe Jukin?
Well, it's similar to what we do with tap dancing. So Jukin and footworking, it's very fast foot movement. And the rhythms, to me, it sounds like tap dancing without tap shoes.
Yeah.
Like they're making rhythms, and it's basically legs. The upper body does very little, and it's a lot of fast movement and intricate rhythms. They're just not making tap sounds. So I always used to say, I think if you put tap shoes on footworkers, you'll get tap dancing.
I love that we can have Ella Fitzgerald and Jukin in the same conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, scatting, Jukin, I think these are all words that were created to describe the way people can interpret rhythm. Like, you know, there's one thing of holding time, which is just 1, 2, 3, 4. But then tap dancing, where is shaka-duka-daka-shaka-duka-duka-da, which is not much different than Ella Fitzgerald scatting over a jazz track, or footworkers Jukin on top of a heavy bass hit.
Yeah. And tap dance is a voice.
Definitely. Yeah.
Brill Barrett, founder of the group Mad Rhythms, they're going to be performing tomorrow night at the Harlem Nights, kind of Halloween night, everybody dressed up in 1920s flapper attire.
Yeah.
Event at Ivy Chicago. For more, go to hereandnow.org. Brill, have a blast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Benny Goodman, Sing, 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 another song the Mad Rhythms Tap Group will perform too. Here Now is a production of NPR in association with the BBC World Service and WBUR Boston. Rest in peace, Mayor Menino. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.